another episode
of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, John McKinnon, the author of The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. John, it's good to be back and to talk about all things prophetic. It's such a touchy subject whenever you talk to people. There are people who there are people who want to corner you and say, do you still believe in the gifts? Anytime that you question something that's fake. And I had a conversation just a few days ago with a person, and I said, it's like those bouncy castles with all the balls. If somebody were to throw a wiffle ball in there and you're trying to find the wiffle ball among all of these other balls, It kind of reminds me of trying to find an authentic among all of the fakery that's happening in all of this movement. It's just a bouncy castle full of balls, right? But whenever I first started coming to terms with the fact that we were in a false religion, prophecy was a big part of it. And for me, I was going through a series of very traumatic life-changing events and doing some soul searching, and I started thinking about prophecy. And one of the first things that hit me, we had a series of prophecies that we were listening to repeated almost every sermon. I don't know how it was in your church, but very, very frequently they would talk about either the seven prophecies of 1933 that Branham had or some other California sinking, whatever it was. They would talk about all these things and they'd say, just look at the world around us. Don't you see X, Y, and Z? Well, I remember suddenly thinking one day, early in my escape and all of this, as I was trying to deprogram, what really did those prophecies mean to me? How did they impact me in any way? How did they help me? How did they comfort me? In fact, most of them were designed to make me scared. That was really what it was for. And as I'm reading the Bible over and over and over again, I'm reading passages like 1 Corinthians 14:3, whoever prophesies speaks to edification and exhortation and comfort. Well, I look back at the 1933 prophecies, what of this was comfort? But the thought that was really hitting me was, what of that mattered to me? Most of it, if you really think about the core of all of the prophecies, the focal point was the prophet, was William Branham. It was basically, see, I prophesied this, hear me. See, I prophesied this, hear me. In other words, there was nothing, see, I prophesied this, and now you get comfort. Now you get edification. None of it really matched what the Bible talks about as prophecy. But more to the point, we weren't allowed to test it. And 1 Thessalonians 5, it says, don't despise prophesyings. It says, prove all things and hold fast to what is good. And I got to thinking about that. There was no door open to hold fast for what was good, because that also opens the door for, well, don't hold fast to this if you disagree with it. You couldn't disagree with their prophecies or you were a heretic, right? So for me, I had to re-examine prophecy. And anyway, it'll make for an interesting discussion today, because none of what we had was really biblical and some of it was just trickery. So I'm glad to have you back. Thanks for coming back.
So today we're going to continue on our discussion of false prophecies. Episode 8, this is part 4 of the false prophecy section. And we realize that these movements, religious, ideological movements, they arise out of these prophetic claims a lot of times. They predict a divine intervention, either world-changing events going to happen, and appointed moments in time that has been prophesied in the Bible. But when such prophecies fail, the outside observers often assume, the movements will just go away and dissolve and, quickly go away. But we find out in history that it shows over and over again that many groups survive failed prophecy. And they not only survive, but they eventually go stronger because of it. So trying to understand why this happens and examining some of these prophecies, which are very clear to us, that they're failures, it's understanding how they reinterpret the failure, I think, is the key, and how they preserve their own identities in the face of this public contradiction of the whole prophecy. So why do they retain, false prophecies? you know, the prediction's rarely treated as a forecast or even a prophecy sometimes. But the failed prophecy becomes a test of their faith in the group, their loyalty to the group, and their perceived spiritual insight. You know, believers are taught that understanding the prophecy, you know, requires a revelation. You can't reason it out with your ordinary reasoning. And as a result, when a prophecy fails, you know, the failure is not interpreted as an error. You know, it's just a misunderstanding. You just didn't understand it correctly. Many groups, they redefine it after the fact. We went over some of those last time. You know, a physical or a visible event that's supposed to happen can be reinterpreted over and over as invisible, spiritual, delayed, conditional. We found that with the brown bear vision of William Branham's. It was conditional. He just wasn't there at the right place at the right time for it to happen. So he missed shooting the bear. This process just allows everybody to affirm that the prophecy actually was real and it was fulfilled, just not in the way you're trying to say it is, and not in the way we expected it to be. So in this way, they preserve their belief and their identity within the group. It doesn't require their admission that the prophecy was false at all. And that's why these things are so strong. So people stay because their commitment is not to the doctrine so much as it is relational and emotional within the group. You know, eventually doctrine doesn't matter so much. The Bible doesn't matter so much as your personal friendships and your family within the group that you don't want to leave. The group has identity. It provides your purpose for living, your belonging, your purpose, your meaning in life even. So leaving it can mean losing your family, friends, your certainty in your spiritual life, and even your sense of self. It's very costly. And psychologically, you know, admitting something that's false creates very much intense internal conflict within you. And so to avoid that, you just double down on your belief that, you know, the prophecy did come to pass, but not in the way I expected. And greater faith is needed, you know, to overcome this. And the response is very well documented in all these groups that do have this happen. The leaders are often frame continued loyalty as proof of your true faith. So that's even after the person made the prophecy is gone, you know, the leaders that are remaining look at you as being your faith is only true if you remain with us and continue to believe in face of all these contradictions. The outside world, of course, would view the group as being deluded and deceptive, manipulative, and with critical thinking, that tends to be how it plays out. Critics focus on the accuracy of the prediction, assuming that failure should easily discredit the leader and discredit the movement, dissolve the group. But we as outsiders now, we underestimate a lot of times the power of those internal narratives and people. You know, what appears to be irrational may feel totally coherent and morally necessary if you're within the group. And so this disconnect here, it leads to misunderstanding of the group sometimes and hostility between the group and the public. And as a result, many prophetic groups like this, they become increasingly isolated. And they interpret that outside criticism as persecution even. So the leader who makes the false prophecies rarely reject it outright. You know, instead, they're portrayed as sincere, maybe misunderstood. They were divinely inspired, but they were humanly fallible. And their authority over the group is actually strengthened at that point as the loyalty to the group becomes your test of spiritual maturity. So all these things tend to play into what we're talking about here and, you know, why groups persist. But I do want to go over some more prophecies that were very plain and why they did not come to pass, or not why they didn't come to pass, but clearly showing that they didn't come to pass. And so we'll go through these here shortly as we get into this, John.
I know we've covered it in the previous episodes, but I want to re-emphasize point that you just brought up, the fact that whenever one of these prophecies turns out to be false and it fails, the group is actually strengthened, which is really odd if you think about the dynamics of just people in general. In all other aspects of life, if something turns out to be false or fraud, everybody turns their hands up and says, no, man, I don't want this. I don't want the fake thing. But in religion, because of the way it has been presented, and because of the way that the people have been indoctrinated to accept it blindly, they just shut off all critical thinking and, okay, it's false. Let's continue. Let's move on. But the thing of it is, like I said earlier, it really just comes down to the basic New Testament question. What is the prophecy supposed to do for the church? And again, I'll stress this throughout the rest of this podcast. It's never really intended to cause fear. If you read the Bible and you understand what it says, you can test to it and hold fast to what is good. Don't hold fast to things that are causing you to be anxious and afraid and scared and give undue power to a person who's claiming these things. There are so many people that they hear the word prophecy and they immediately think prediction. And that is because these prophecies have been designed to put the focal point back on the person who's saying them. In other words, look, I told you this was going to happen. I remember having conversations when I was a kid with somebody who constantly said, I told you that was going to happen. And you just got so tired of it. And then to think that, yes, I was tired of it whenever I was in that setting, but when I go to church, I hear somebody that's doing it over and over behind the pulpit, and I just accepted it. Why did I do that? Well, it all comes back to the indoctrination. People hear that, and they just simply, they shut off their critical thinking. They think, okay, that was a prediction. He predicted it. This must be the guy. Instead of, well, I should probably test that. Nobody really stops and says, I should probably test that. And for me, the biggest test of all is, how does it help you? How does the prophecy impact your life? Does it make you afraid? Does it make you anxious? Are you having to go see therapists after leaving a group that's like this? Well, that's really what it comes down to. And again, to reemphasize, when the prophecy fails, and we'll get into some of these failure examples, it strengthens the church because they have just completely shunned all critical thinking.
Yeah, John, you know, this groups are just, they have a dynamic on their own, and they will persist and they will double down because, you know, people in general don't want to be wrong. And we see this over and over again. When you've made up your mind one way, it's too painful to reject that. And we find that true no matter how bad the group gets, actually, that they take it to their death. And we found that in the case of Jonestown. And most recently, you get into the Branch Davidians, which was just an offshoot of, you know, Seventh-day Adventism. That's where they had their roots. But that's one of the more recent ones that went into error and had a leader who claimed revelation, actually claimed to be the Lamb of Revelation and claimed to open the seven seals back in 1993, and right before their compound was destroyed. But it resulted in the siege back in 93 of Waco, in Waco, Texas. It ended in a terrible disaster. But we see that some of these groups can, with apocalyptic claims and isolationism and communes, they tend to end very destructively at times. So I'm sort of thankful in one way the message movement overall hasn't done that. They have independent churches, but there are cases, you know, we know in groups that did form communes that ended in disaster, such as the Trailer Park, say in Arizona, Colonia Dignidad, and others. So it's not without, it could happen at any time. So it pays to look at the history of these things so we can be very aware of them. There was another one that was part of the Davidian movement, Shepherd's Rod. It was another offshoot. But in 1959, they prophesied the establishment of a kingdom in Palestine. Of course, that failed. Modern day Adventist influence, date speculation, independent teachers have established 1988 as being the 40 years after Israel was declared a state, as being something significant happening. One person stated the rapture was going to occur. Year 2000 was millennium expectations. And even in more recent times, the blood moon prophecies. And none of that failed to materialize anything of significance. So I'm going to get into one thing here that William Branham taught in 1977, of course. He said, You know, most people, some people in thought there was no more grace after 1963. You know, Brenham never really said that, but people inferred that based on what he said in his sermons. But since that time, there's been many date setters in the message. And his most famous one was 1977, because he said, as a private student of the Word with multitudes of visions, and he claimed none had ever failed, he said, you know, let me predict that this age will end in 1977. And he put a disclaimer on there. I'm not prophesying, but I'm predicting. That was in the church ages. So the quote shows his own predictive statement that the age would end around 1977. It had a lot of stirring among believers. And in that time, these statements are ignored today, but they just never materialize. Just like every time we get close to a presidential election and possibly electing that woman president, you know, message believers are eager to say that this is the one that he prophesied about. But then when it doesn't happen, you know, it turns out to be a flop. They just ignore everything they just predicted. And that'll continue until one day we maybe will have maybe a woman president. Then it'll become statements like after she comes and goes, it'll be like, well, she's not the one, but there's one coming that can go on. And that'll go on long after we're probably gone, John, maybe. But, you know, it's going to continue. They find ways to reinterpret the prophecies, and you know, even though they never come to pass. And by this time, many years has gone by. People spent their productive lives in something, you know, that tends to be a waste. And I hate to see that for the ones in the movement today, John.
And the female president prediction, I'm calling it prediction and not prophecy. You'll see why in a minute. It's actually a very clear example of what I said earlier about prophecies that point to the leader for the sole purpose of elevating, lifting, giving authority to the leader. It actually benefits me in no way, shape, or form, whether the gender of the president is male or female. I really could care less. What it does is, if you take all of the doctrines that he linked to that, it turns you politically inspired to vote against a specific party if you understood the context of what he said during the era that he said it. He was trying very hard to push politics and religion. That's why he was doing this. And if you read everything he says, it is a prediction, because he's literally guessing that something is going to happen. But what's odd is he has to change it so much that the female president prophecy he said was fulfilled with John F. Kennedy until Kennedy died. And then it changed again. And people are scratching their heads saying, wait a minute, John F. Kennedy was a male, not a female. Well, the way that this works is, if you throw out a prediction, and in this case, he's got a 50-50 chance. Throw out a prediction and you got a 50 chance of being male or female. Well, what he realized was that it's not likely to happen, because there are just too many people who would vote against a female person. Maybe let's change it a bit. And he says, well, maybe it's a vice president. And then he says, eventually, maybe it's the Catholic Church. Well, then he tried to say it was JFK, because JFK was Catholic. And it's this circular reasoning. Like you said, it's, you know, you get it wrong, well, people just double down, and then you change it. Get it wrong again, double down, change, and it's this vicious cycle that will continue throughout eternity, because these cults will always survive and exist. So for me, I have to take it back to, does it edify the church? Does it do anything for me? And in fact, I have the decision. If you read the Bible and understand what the Bible says, I have the decision to say simply, I don't care about that prophecy. You can talk about it all you want. Don't talk about it in my church. I don't want to hear it in my church, because it does nothing for me.
So, John, just I want to zero in, because what you said is very true. And I want to zero in now on William Branham's 1933 prophecies. You know, he did claim he had seven major predictions that would unfold before the end. And among these predictions that were commonly cited was Mussolini would invade Ethiopia. He would meet a violent end. One said that Hitler would lead the world into war, and another one said that Franklin Roosevelt would lead the world into war. Woman would rise to power, a great destruction of America, a car without a steering wheel, and the end of age would occur around 1977. So we got all these things happening. And I'll read you the actual quote here. But we're going to find that there's many contradictions within these statements, but those are basically the seven, you know, major visions that he said he had. But interestingly, you know, he didn't really speak about these on tape until a long, long time after, you know, 1933. And in fact, it might have been 1960 or so. But all these things had a background that we're maybe not aware of, which we'll bring to light here. So, John, I'd like to focus on these 1933 prophecies. So it was very late after they supposedly were written down or spoken that he really started talking about these. And so by the time he started talking about these, very hard to go back and figure out, did he really say these things in 1933 or not? So in 1960, he preached a message, Condemnation by Representation, and he said that he'd like to read a prophecy that was given. And he says, he's got, by the way, Mr. Mercer, some of them are going to take some of these old prophecies, dig them out, revise them a little, bring them up to date, put them in papers. And he said, I'd like to read for you this one first. I'd like to read something to you. And he says, 1932, listen to this. I was on my way, getting waited for church this morning. It came to pass, I fell into a vision. So he says, I speak these things in the name of the Lord. And then the first thing he said was the president, which now is Franklin Roosevelt. Now remember, 28 years ago, he said, will cause the whole world to go to war. So that was one thing. And we'll get into what Franklin Roosevelt and how this is actually contradicted in his later book called The Church Ages. But then he also says the next vision foretold that an Austrian by the name of Adolf Hitler would rise up as dictator over Germany. He would draw the world into war. So already you've got a contradiction there. I guess why he said Franklin Roosevelt and why the prophecy was written down that way and later changed, you know, I do not know, other than maybe because Liouville compiled the Church Age books and felt it was more accurate to put Adolf Hitler in there, which it is. I mean, and another one that he mentions, he says, as a new dictator of Italy, Mussolini shall make his first invasion towards Ethiopia. He will take it, but that will be his last. He'll come to his end. So in this prediction, he's predicting that Mussolini is going to make one move to Ethiopia, and that's going to be it. But we find out, and Mussolini didn't really end after that invasion. Well, the actual events that happened after his conquest of Ethiopia, he enjoyed a temporary boost in prestige, proclaiming an actual Italian empire in May of 36. And then this victory in Ethiopia was costly to him, of course, but it was not until 1945 that he was actually executed. A lot of things happened between then and the time he was executed, though. They actually had the Rome-Berlin Axis. Italy intervened in the Spanish Civil War. They sent troops in 1939. He signed a pact of steel with Hitler, a full military alliance, and invaded Albania and annexed it easily. So he had other military conquest after Ethiopia. So it really wasn't as simple as he was trying to make it out in the prophecy that he invaded Ethiopia, then he died. So people will find a way to explain that away, though, and say, well, he was right in the fact that Mussolini died and he did invade Ethiopia, if in fact he did say it in 1933. So really, allies eventually invaded Italy, and that's when Mussolini, after he fled away, he was eventually executed. So a lot of things happened. It wasn't as simple as, say, the vision, you know, stated. He also mentioned the one about the egg-shaped cars, science progressing and having egg-shaped cars by eventually showing that car running down the highway without a steering wheel. So it's kind of interesting to note that in Jeffersonville and newspapers in 1933, there was articles about egg-shaped cars in the papers, and cars should begin to take on egg-shaped. So it's not very unusual that he would come out later with a prophecy saying cars will look like egg-shaped. He said, finally they'll build one without a steering wheel, and he said they've got it now, controlled by some other power. Now, he spoke this in 1960. When he spoke this, there was already an article in Time in 1956 that showed a car that looked similar to what he was describing. It didn't have a steering wheel. People were in the back playing checkers. And now you wouldn't think kids are going to be there with their iPhones or PlayStations or whatever playing versus playing checkers in the back of a car. So I don't think that prophecy is going to be fulfilled exactly as what he saw. But, you know, the interesting part of this whole thing is that by the time he was speaking this, there was already a picture of a car going down the highway without a steering wheel with people in the back doing the very thing he's talked about in a vision in, you know, in Time magazine. So the earliest time I can see where he spoke about egg-shaped cars, and he didn't mention no steering wheel at that time until after the Time magazine came out. That was around 1953. Here's what he said here. He said, just before that time comes, that automobiles, which was built straight back 20 years ago, 25 years ago. You remember 20 years anyhow. I said they'll look like an egg. They'll be shaped. That's a vision. Be something on the shape like that. And that's the way it'll be just before the rapture. But he didn't say anything about, you know, having no steering wheel, playing checkers in the back of the car until the Church Age book came out. And that was well after this article in Time magazine, which showed the car. So these things are just the tip of the iceberg. You know, we could go through line by line and exact detail, but we don't have a lot of time to do that. But these were supposed to be seven visions written down in 1933, although there's no old papers produced ever shown where we're seeing this evidence where they were actually done. I agree they may have been written down, but whether they were ever written down in 1933 or not, I don't know, because Mr. Mercer or Mr. Goad were constantly revising the prophecies probably. But nothing proves it was spoken before the time that he was speaking it there. There's no evidence of that. And in these specific visions, there, you know, you always find something in the newspapers or magazines that showed what these visions were prior to the time he spoke about it. But these are just examples of how these things were spoken. Now, nowadays we try to explain them away, or we try to see that the driverless cars that are happening now is a fulfillment of that. Although there's no way you can play checkers, maybe in the back of the car, you wouldn't want to, in other words, in today's times.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
You know, growing up, I was a car enthusiast, I'm an artist, so I was actually drawing several pictures in my sketchbook of these old-timey cars. And if you remember the really old ones from the, you know, 1920s, 1930s, it was this really block-style vehicle, and they began to shift over time. They became a little bit more rounded edges, etc. Well, I was drawing this at a time whenever I was working with my father. We were rebuilding Corvettes constantly, and I remember looking at the sleek aerodynamic design of the, we were usually working on 1980s Corvettes, and it was just low profile, it was sleek, it was aerodynamic. And I remember seeing the Ford Taurus. I saw a white one drive by, and back then in the 80s, the Ford Taurus was also more rounded edges, more it looked like a rounded brick going down the road. Is in my opinion, it was a little bit ugly. But I remember thinking and comparing those two, well, look at that. Cars are becoming more and more shaped like an egg. William Branham got the prophecy right. But there were so many things that I didn't know. And even as an auto enthusiast, I didn't know this. I did not know that as early as 1916, they were talking about egg-shaped cars in the newspapers. I found actually on the website, you can look at some of the articles I have. This was nothing new in 1933. In fact, if somebody in 1933 were to have heard him say, "I prophesy that cars will become shaped by an egg," somebody would just simply call him out outside the service and say, "Man, you read that from the newspapers. What are you talking about?" Everybody knows this. And he talks about going to the World's Fair. Well, at the World's Fair, they had a literal egg. Like the car was actually shaped like an egg on display. It's called the Dymaxion, I think it is. And the car actually in the 33 World's Fair turned over and burned because egg's not a good design. It's also top heavy, so it's going to flip over. Well, it did, and it caught fire, and cars began to shift and change, and they did become more aerodynamic, but that was way back in the 30s. It wasn't something that happened towards what he would call or consider the end time, especially 1977. If you really look at the timeline, fast forward to 1977, the year that he's talking about, this is when it's all going to end. Well, cars in the 70s became bigger and blockier, and they kind of reverted back from aerodynamics to this big muscle car style that was really blocky. Think 1968, the Charger and the Dukes of Hazzard. Big old block car. It looks nothing like an egg, right? Well, that's because they were going back towards the muscle cars. Well, now it's shifting again, and it's becoming rounded and more edges, and people are saying, "Oh, look, the prophecy." And they don't know the history of automobiles, right? And they also don't know that this happened long before he said. They also don't know, most of the Branhamites don't know, that that prophecy changed after he visited another World's Fair to the one that you're talking about. It will be self-driving, and they'll be sitting there playing checkers. They actually had that vehicle at the World's Fair in Seattle, which Branham attended. So, and it's like you said, it was all over the newspapers and articles, advertisements for some, I can't remember the name, but it's an electric company advertisement that was being pushed. Long story short, the prophecy that he had no bearing whatsoever on my salvation. I came to terms with that early 2012. That was my favorite prophecy because I was a car enthusiast. And I started thinking, that was really foolish of me. It doesn't really matter to me in one way, shape, or form the shape of a vehicle. The only thing that it did was point my mind to him as the prophet who said it. It didn't edify me. It didn't help me. It didn't prepare me. There was absolutely nothing scriptural about this prophecy. There was nothing that satisfied the Bible descriptions of what prophecies are supposed to be according to New Testament prophecy. And I became suddenly aware that's why he was pushing the idea of an Old Covenant prophet, not a New Testament prophet. And there was this blurred line between the two, because what he wanted to become essentially was, he wanted to become a prophet leader, and he wanted to become a prophet, basically a prophet Messiah is what he was pushing. We'll get into that probably in the future, but nothing about it was New Testament. And I started to have to learn the covenants. Why there's an Old Covenant? Why the Old Testament, they were living under Old Covenant law? What was the difference between Old Covenant law and grace? And why would a New Testament prophet need to be different than an Old Covenant prophet? They weren't messengers of the covenant, right? Well, Branham wanted to be a messenger of the covenant. And in the end, what he was doing was he was taking people away from the gospel and pointing them back to the law.
We can go on and on, like I said, for days and days with these visions and just show how each one, pick them apart, because we really want to know the truth. We want to lay them side by side with reality. But one of the most striking ones that I will mention, and I've always, after I studied this in depth, you know, it really is striking to me that it's a very strong example of failed prophecy. But it was the India trip. You know, it was supposed to have 300,000 people saved during that time. And even in the India vision, you know, it wasn't very clear whether it was supposed to be Africa or India. Turned out to be neither. But, you know, he did mention it was strongly related to India. That's where he thought it was. So pictures shown from that trip, it shows that the church, you know, that he preached in wasn't even full. You know, he was resisted by the churches in the area from having the meetings when he finally got to have the meetings. And he even blamed a woman preacher for being him being unpopular when he arrived. But he began to make vague statements after that about putting the crowd size being estimated at 500,000. And he always put it off on the mayor of Bombay as saying that. So he never had to say it was him saying it. It was somebody else saying it. So that's how this thing came about. But look at how he described it here in the Second Coming, 1955. He said, in India, just get ready to believe anything when you go to India almost. I never seen such confusion in my life. So they told me I'd not have to not get out in the open, but we would have to stand beside because his sister caused trouble. He's talking about the woman preacher. And we would have a church, would have to be held in a church, for they could not give protection out there. But they would if it would be in a church and manage it. And the mayor himself told me there was 500,000 people in the city had come there for the healing service for the meeting. And you can imagine what would be in the streets of Bombay. And they had a great big church there. I don't know. It was some kind of Episcopal church. Way away, two times the size of this auditorium. 3,000 people max, I would say. And great big yard out there in front would cover 1/2 acre. And there were these microphones. And the people were there for block after block. And they had patrol cars run up there with these walkie-talkies trying to make room for me to come in an automobile to get to the place where we're going to pray for the sick. He said, you've never seen such in your life. People would be stacked like cordwood on one on top of another. Now, the way he described this, nothing's real definite about it. It's always, we couldn't have it in the open air. It would have to be held in the church for protection. And then the mayor himself told me that 500,000 came for the meeting. We don't know that to be true. And he just kept saying, building the image up in people's minds, he says, you can imagine what that would be in the streets of Bombay. But nothing real definite there. And he said they had a great big church there. You know, big churches, I don't know. I would estimate if you could get 3,000 people in a church, you got a big crowd. But I doubt it was that big by the pictures we've seen, you know, of that meeting. And then he had to say there was some great big yard out in front, about 1/2 acre where all the people could sit. Well, 1/2 acre, if you measure 1/2 acre, that's about 2,000 square meters. And extreme, say, mosh pit density people, which is dangerous. I looked this up. Only about 8,000 or 9,000 people could fit there, you know, in 1/2 acre. It's not recommended because there's a high extreme for crush risk. So how can 8,000 people even that be even close to 500,000? You know, there's just no way that could even happen. The physics of this cannot take place as to what he's describing here.
I still get contacted from people about that saying, well, that prophecy came true, because they have to defend it. It is the only prophecy that William Branham openly admitted to have failed. And then he later would say things like, if you ever find one single detail wrong with a prophecy, you can hang a sign on my back that says false prophet. Well, whenever you do that, when you actually hang the sign on his back like we've done, you get this outcry from the people saying, no, we disagree that William Branham admitted it has failed. That's how strong the mind control is in this type of thing. They just have to uplift it no matter what. And India prophecy is a good example, because there is no way possible, like you said, just thinking logically, there's no way that it could happen. But the fact that he admitted it didn't happen, that should be enough for people to just say, okay, this guy's not a prophet.
So if you remember back in that sermon he preached in 1955 called The Second Coming that we talked about, he said they had a great big church there, I don't know, some kind of Episcopal church, way away, two times the size of this auditorium. So as I described this, this auditorium he was preaching in, you could get about 1,500 people if you put them in their theater style comfortably. So you're only talking about 3,000 people max. But he's talking about 500,000 people or lots of people coming to this meeting. So we see that even if he says, well, the church was about twice the size of this one, you can't get that many people there. What would it take for 500,000 people to really be in an area? For safe, comfortable densities of 500,000, you're talking about 62 acres. For a moderate density, you need about 31 acres. For very, very high density, you still need 20 acres. Extreme, which means it's very unsafe, you need 10 to 12 acres. So an outdoor gathering, you plan on 50 to 100 acres total to allow space for movement, emergency access, and viewing the church centrally. So we see that these pictures we have, we don't have any pictures of the outside where he was even had that many people. But it's kind of strange. You look at South Africa meetings and you have pictures all around of those meetings. And you see there was only 75,000 people maybe there at that racetrack. But we're talking about 500,000 people here. So you need a much larger venue. But then there's no pictures of that.
No, there's not. And that's something that really should make people just pause and think, because he's saying things like there are going to be tens of thousands times 10,000 saved. You're going to read it when I come back in the newspapers. Well, nobody did. Nobody read it. But more to the point, like you just said, you look through any of the photographs, nothing matches what he's talking about. If it did happen, you can be sure that with the campaign team that was there, they would have had 1,000 photographs, and you'd read about it in Voice of Healing. You'd read about it on the front walls of every church, man, because this was a proven prophecy had it happened. The problem is it just simply didn't happen.
You know, when he first came back, I think he was a little heavy-hearted because the meetings just weren't what they should have been. And there was a couple of instances where he alluded to that. In 1957, India Trip Report in January, he said, and when I had been very much constrained to go to India, he said, and yet, as many of you might know, the Indian trip wasn't the success it should have been, because I failed to follow the leading of the Holy Spirit, never recognized it, after he gave me a vision to go to Africa first and then to India. So he has to start explaining this vision away that was so spectacular to him that, I failed the vision, and it didn't come to pass because I did something wrong. So, but he admits that it's not a very good success, and we've shown that with the church he was in, can only hold at most, say, 3,000 people, and then the venue for the streets in Bombay in a city, you'd have to have 60 acres of open land just to get the people there. So even if they line the streets up and down, there's no way you could get 500,000 people there with all the buildings and things that's in the city. So then he turns around a year later in January of 58 and then starts proclaiming how great the meetings were. So then he says, I had the privilege just the last couple of years of having one of the greatest meetings the Lord ever let me have in Bombay, India. So for whatever reason, he changes his tune and he starts telling people that he had the greatest meeting he ever had. This was in January of 58 in a message called The Called Out. In 1961, he continues on stating this time and time again. Not the only time, of course. There's many, many times he says this, but I'll read another quote. He says, Was you in Africa that time, brother? Was you there? No. India? Oh, yeah. Well, maybe I get a chance to speak of India. Was you there when I was in India? Not there. That's where I had my greatest gathering. At Bombay, 500,000 at one time. So, you see, he really believed, I guess, at some point that he had the greatest meeting he ever had, whereas the other time he said it was not the success that he should have had. And we don't have any pictures other than the one in the church where he was definitely said he was inside of a church, and we do have those pictures that show the meeting wasn't very large. So, it's hard to believe that was a vision that actually came to pass. You know, a few others I'll mention won't go into detail, except the killing of the brown bear. Of course, we know that didn't happen. Planning to fulfill the tent vision. The bridge prophecy, even, that was supposed to have been one that he saw and the men died off of. That's been truly shown that it was not, you know, a true prophecy because it didn't happen. And it was definitely not the way he described it in detail, even if we give him the benefit of the doubt. That a bridge was built, it definitely was not according to the way he described it with the number of men that died. Another very important one is that's not come to pass yet, that, and I wonder if this will not be the silver bullet, will be the destruction of Los Angeles, because already we've seen as time has gone on, you know, Los Angeles hasn't sunk beneath the ocean and has not come to pass as Billy Paul has related it. Was supposed to come to pass while he was still alive, and sharks were supposed to be swimming in downtown Los Angeles while he was still alive. But now that he's gone on, people are quietly dismissing that prophecy in some way, but he spoke it as a thus saith the Lord. This was in 1965, November. Works' faith expressed. He said, California, Los Angeles will sink. It's going down. She'll slide right into the ocean. And then he talks about the Alaskan earthquake. He said, I didn't know nothing happened until I got on the street. It told, which he's talking about the angel now, it told California, said, Capernaum, the city that's called by the name of the angels, that's Los Angeles. You've exalted yourself into heaven, but you'll be brought down into hell. He said, now the last few days, it's a great roaring and popping. Then here come a paper of science, said it's all honeycombed. It's got to go under. They just know it. And you watch, the water will come plumb back into the Salton Sea. Los Angeles is doomed for judgment. I tell you before it happens that you might know when it does happen. I never spoke that by myself. I never heard him. I've never had him to tell me one thing but what happened. And you can bear record of that. That's right. When? I don't know. He said it again in December of 1965. Do you know what the Lord says about Los Angeles, these places here? She's gone. You remember what I told you about 2 years ago? He said, Church, you're doomed. Not only California, you're doomed. Church, unless you get right with God, you're doomed. Thus saith the Holy Spirit. So he's definitely made this a prophecy. And so I hope message people will certainly take a look at this very hard, because he's only going by scientific papers that are saying at the time, you know, a lot of people have conjectured that California could fall off. But the idea that Los Angeles or California will dramatically fall into the ocean is a myth. It's popularized by movies and misinformation that's out there, because really, in reality, it's geologically impossible. And the way the plates are moving, Los Angeles sits on a boundary. There's a Pacific plate and a North American plate. So Los Angeles is sliding past the North American plate. And the slip is only about 1 to 2 inches a year past each other. And it's called a strike slip fault. Plates are moving horizontally past. Now, there can be earthquakes that happen along that boundary, but no significant vertical motion. There's no mechanism for large sections of land to suddenly drop or sink into the sea. Over a long period of time, you know, Los Angeles will continue to slide past and go up to San Francisco. But we're talking about a million years from now. And the ocean floor underneath it is a solid crystal plate. It's not a hole, and it's not a hole for land to fall into there. Earthquakes can cause intense shaking and lateral displacement side to side, but not catastrophic separation as we see in the movies. So some sinking has occurred in Los Angeles, but this is due to groundwater extraction. And it's only been at the rates of a few millimeters or centimeters per year. You got oil being pumped, groundwater extractions, natural sediment compaction over time. And of course, that makes the sea levels rise somewhat, and added inches to water levels increasing by 2050 in certain hot spots. And this gradual land lowering is not a sudden plunge into the ocean. So the myth continues, because earthquakes do happen in that city, and they can be pretty catastrophic. But the city is firmly placed on continental crust, and it's going to stay there. It's not going to disintegrate and fall into the ocean. So, and there's also been reports of submarines traveling underneath Los Angeles, and that's also a myth. They've not been traveling underneath Los Angeles.
And just to pause and give some context for people who weren't in the Branham movement, and you hear this and you say, oh my gosh, Los Angeles, I recognize that. Well, you do. It's because there are people who, like in IHOP KC, John Paul Jackson, resurrected this idea that he was claiming that Los Angeles would sink. Well, this was nothing new with John Paul Jackson. It actually was back to Branham, and I recently did a podcast. It was actually nothing new with Branham. You can go back before Branham, and you can find other people saying it. Branham himself said that he learned about this before he even claimed to have had a prophecy. He talked about watching TV, and he learned it on the TV. So there's just so many problems with this, and the biggest of which, like you mentioned, Branham said it would happen before his son was an old man, his son who has now died of old age.
So John, even though we see Los Angeles, you know, there's not evidence that it is going to fall, because, you know, they've studied the area. They know, we well know the geography of the area. And so back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, not much was well known. But nowadays, it's been studied enough to where I'm pretty sure that scientists feel like Los Angeles is on stable ground, so it's not going to just all of a sudden plunge into the ocean. And on top of that, you know, the prophecy that mentions Capernaum was in the bottom of the sea. Well, Capernaum has never been in the bottom of the sea, so I don't think the Holy Spirit would also say something that's incorrect, you know, regarding this prophecy.
The Los Angeles sinking prophecy, that is another one that really emphasizes what I said at the beginning. That doesn't edify me at all to think about Los Angeles sinking. It does cause a little bit of fear and anxiety. In fact, when I flew out there, I remember stepping on the ground and almost falling over because of that fear and anxiety. It wasn't edifying to me. It didn't help me. It didn't give me comfort. And that's what the New Testament talks about. Now, there is a scenario where it could be biblical. If Branham were truly concerned about the lives of the people and God were speaking through him to help save lives instead of them dying in this massive destruction, that could be seen as biblical because that would be give comfort to them. Get out, get to safety. But it wasn't that. It was a prophecy of condemnation. If you listen to everything he says, he really says it in anger, and he's mostly angry because most of the churches have cut him off by that point. He was down to, I think at the end, only the Full Gospel Businessmen would even have him. He had said so many heretical things. He'd been pushed out of all of the churches. Well, he's speaking in anger, so this was a prophecy in anger. It wasn't prophecy to edify. So for me, the whole thing is just anti-biblical. This is an anti-biblical prophet, but I question even prophet because some of the things, like we've said, most of the things he said came after the fact. Those that didn't come after the fact, he got wrong. So how can you label him a prophet?
So, John, I do agree with that. I mean, that's so true. And, you know, we're coming to the end of this and understanding these that people do persist with prophecies that are false. It doesn't matter, you know, ever how, because you can interpret these things 100 different ways. So it's just the fact that it was thrown out there by a man that they have a lot of trust in. It doesn't matter who the man is or who the woman is. You know, if they have a lot of trust in what they're saying and that they believe that they have spiritual insights, you know, they're going to put a lot of trust in their prophecy.
And more to the point, it's so that they can put their focus and their faith in the prophet. It's a prophecy to uplift the prophet. That's really all, everything that we've mentioned, that's really all that this is. So why do people do this?
Well, we get to that same concept we said in the beginning, is cognitive dissonance. You know, people don't abandon beliefs just because things happen. They have to avoid the pain and discomfort in their minds, and they do this by reinterpreting the evidence. They can reinterpret how things were supposed to happen, and in their minds, they can rationalize it, why this contradiction appears, and why it appears to be a contradiction but really isn't. And then they can blame the misunderstanding on outsiders, you know, that you just don't understand. You know, only if you're in the inner circle would you understand why you have to believe this. And then they continue to add new beliefs that, you know, support the old one. And they double down on their commitment, but it's all to get relief, you know, in their minds from the discomfort that they're feeling, the tensions that they're feeling. It doesn't have to be truth. So the major insight that we can glean from this, and the most important conclusion on all this, you know, when prophecy fails, is that people are often more committed to the beliefs after they're disproven. If abandoning the beliefs would cost them too much psychologically or even socially. Truth is just not enough to change people's minds. It's just the way it is. You know, the book that was written, When Prophecy Fails, you know, it's very influential beyond, you know, what it was written for. Because these insights that they gathered by studying this group, it applies to not only religious cults and failed end-time movements, but it applies to political ideologies as well. Even conspiracy theories, why people strongly believe in those. Maybe why we didn't go to the moon or why the earth is flat. Or even high control religious groups. So all these things are playing to this very same concept. So I think the book was very important because it shows that belief persistence is not really about evidence here. Not really about critical thinking. But it's about your identity. about who you are and who you come to believe you are. It's about your community, the people you associate with. It's very detrimental. It's very destructive to the person's identity to leave the group you're associated with. Very painful, because there's such an emotional investment in the whole thing. So when the belief becomes who we are, and then admitting the error feels like a self-destruction of the person. And that's very devastating. That's why we can run into mental issues by leaving a group. Why we may need therapy. Why we need support. Because it's very painful. But I think truth is definitely more important in the end than staying with a group that is holding on to things that's not true. Because in the end, you know, you're not built on a good foundation. And as Christians, we want to build on a good foundation. We don't want to just be in a group because of our social influence. And if you look at that, that's what's going to hold you and carry you through, is your belief that you're going to get on a firm foundation. And of course, that will be the scriptures. So that's what this is all about. And that will conclude basically all about false prophecies here. To finish up in a couple more episodes, John, I want to go over, you know, the very thing that sparked this whole series. And it was a couple of letters that William Branham wrote to various men to promote his own self. And I'll get into that next time, John.
Sounds good. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more information about Roy Davis and William Branham, you can read The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.